Hi everybody, welcome again to BitNote. We'll be talking about video games, video game music, and just having a fun time in the world of interactive entertainment. Or, I can't believe I used that phrase. Enjoy! So, once again, for this show, I'll be doing something a little bit different. Instead of just diving right into music, I'm going to tell you all a story. Yes? That is right. It is time for BitNote's very first BitNote story time. Once upon a time, there was a man named Stefan Eriksson who came from the far-off land of Sweden. Stefan was a very naughty boy when he was very, very little. He would steal things and he would deal cocaine. And when he was 19 years old, he was arrested for trying to rob a bank van. Well, after he left prison, he thought, I must change. I can't just keep on doing crime by myself. I must involve other people with me so that they can help me and that way we can't get caught. And so, Stefan made friends with other people, such as Johan Enander and Peter Uff. And they engaged in a wide variety of criminal practices that would make them money. For instance, sometimes someone would owe money, and they would have to be called in order to get that money back. And if they had to shove a barrel of a gun down someone's throat in order to threaten them, they would do that. They soon had a great reputation and became known as the Upalasa Mafia. And so they continued on their criminal ways for years, staying one step ahead of the police and intimidating any potential witnesses with threats of violence at every opportunity to make sure that they won't get caught. But as time went by, the police became more and more caught on to them. They tried to make lots and lots of money, but the police managed to catch their counterfeiting operation. And then when they tried to withdraw money from countless bank accounts that weren't theirs, they were caught and sent to prison. So Stefan Eriksson was alone once again in prison and dealing with the consequences of his actions. When he left prison at the dawn of the new millennium, he realized he needed to change his ways and come across some form of theft and criminal activity that wouldn't be so easy to trace. And so he decided to start a company. He, of course, involved some friends and people he knew, such as Carl Freer, who himself had got his start in criminal enterprises by forging checks. But much like Stefan Eriksson himself, Carl had realized that if he wanted to make money, he would have to change his ways and think a lot bigger. He realized that while taking money from banks would make him money, it would be far, far easier to take huge amounts of money from rich people. So he started a business and started pitching it to investors. The idea was fairly simple. What parent wouldn't pay huge amounts of money to know where their child is at every single time? Parents were very much worried and would pay huge amounts of money for this. So therefore, he invested in a company called Eagle Eye Scandinavia, which would basically have GPS devices, global positioning systems, that would be bought by parents to make sure that parents always had the exact location of all their children. Of course, there was a problem with this. Not so much the gigantic civil rights abuse, because of course children aren't considered to have rights, but the more specific point about how exactly could we become publicly traded. You see, when you have a company, you can sell shares in it. If someone buys a share of your company, then they are entitled to a share of the profits, or they can sell that share on to other people. And Carl Freer wanted many, many, many rich people to buy many, many, many shares in the company so that huge amounts of money would go into his account and he would probably use it in a way that he felt was most appropriate. But how does one company become able to sell shares? Well, my friend, in order to do that, it must become publicly traded and have an initial public offering, in which places the members of the public are able to buy these shares. But Carl Freer had a problem. Any sort of initial public offering would cause huge amounts of investigation and work and legwork in order to be able to make these shares available. So what did he do? He thought very, very smart. He found he discovered an American company called Floor Decor, who was actually a publicly traded company. And then he convinced them to completely buy over his own company. So now, Carl Freer had a company that was publicly traded, except for with the small problem that it was called Floor Decor and dealt with floors, rather than one that dealt with GPS-enabled child tracking systems. So that was easily remedied by convincing the original owners to change their business type and also to change their name from Floor Decor to Tiger Telematics. No, not Tiger Electronics, who made all those cool LCD games which you played back in the days before portable game systems with interchangeable cartridges became popular, but Tiger Telematics. So now, with this thing, they decided to revise their whole child tracking approach with the simple question of what exactly will convince children to carry around GPS tracking devices? So they thought this over, and then it became obvious: a game system. So things were getting exciting. Tiger Telematics wasn't just producing a kid tracking device, they were actually producing an actual handheld video game console. And it would go on and become so popular and get lots of people to invest in it. And so they decided on the name. It was originally going to be called the Game Track, but then it was changed to the Gizmondo. The Gizmondo handheld gaming device. Completely separate from the online website, the technology website called Gizmodo. No, this is the Gizmondo. There's a single letter difference. And so they were going to go forward with this exciting new games console, and for it they needed investors. So in the United Kingdom, they set up Gizmondo Europe, and in that company they started going out and getting huge amounts of investment for this great Gizmondo device. They had so much publicity, they were built. Carl Freer was on fire. People would be desperately asking to invest in his device once he talked to them about its exciting possibilities, how it would revolutionize the gaming landscape, how everybody would want them. He got big names, he got celebrities in them, he got huge PR campaigns, and even eventually down the line, the Gizmondo actually had a shop that would open up in Regent Street, like an Apple shop or any other product shop, but specifically for selling Gizmondo game devices. Of course, Carl and Stefan made sure that they were well looked after. They couldn't just keep going on this huge enterprise unless they made sure that they felt they were getting their fair share. So Carl made sure to give himself a $2.2 million salary and made sure that his wife was well looked after by hiring her as a consultant in the company for $174,000. And so it continued. Of course, they were funneling huge amounts of money into this company that would produce this great handheld device, but they have to make sure that essentials were covered. Essentials such as making sure that Carl Freer had a gigantic mansion in the English countryside and a huge amount of impressive automobiles, and making sure that there were plenty of parties on yachts and high-passed powered auto cars. And indeed, even Stefan Ericsson himself, made sure that he was well looked after by trying to participate in Le Mans 24 in his Ferrari, which he loved so dearly. And so things continued. There were companies called Northern Lights, which Freer and Ericsson owned part of, and so they naturally gave huge amounts of work to for just researching games concepts. And then, of course, there was Game Factory, which was directed by one of Freer's friends, and they made sure that Game Factory got a lot of huge amounts of business too. So things geared up for the great launch. You see, they weren't just wasting all the money away on decadent luxuries, oh no. They also were actually making the games device, and at least one person on the general board actually felt that actually was the company's objective. That man was Michael Carender, who had worked in Floor Decor and became the chief financial officer when Floor Decor had bought out the company that was to become Tiger Telematics. And so they attended to these things. They gave showings, they recruited developers, they paid huge sums to major third-party publishers that they would provide games for the device. So soon things were ready. The device had been created. It was ready to be sold. The launch was coming up, and they even had a shop directly in London to sell the game directly to people. This was it. This was the moment what would actually happen, when the game's handheld console would be released. In the history of video games, there have been so many instances of great exciting things happening when a console is launched. Sometimes there are news reports of people waiting out line for hours and even days beforehand. And other times, the console is in so much demand that it gets sold out and then resold for huge prices on eBay. So with this backdrop, the Gizmondo had its European release. Very rare for a console to be released in Europe first, but it was released in Europe first. But not many people bought it. After all this expenditure and all this money and all this manufacturing of this great, powerful console that had got so much support and so much excitement about the investors, no one was buying the device, and no one was really that interested in it. It didn't help that the device was really only sold in a couple of different shops and then online, but it also didn't help that it only had one game for it, which was a remake of a game that had originally played on the Commodore 64. It also didn't help that it was for approximately 400 euro, and that many people didn't have that money. But what really damaged the device ultimately was that the core gamers, the hardcore gamers, the people who would buy these devices and at release date, just didn't feel that the device would actually be successful. They didn't have confidence in the device. They didn't want to buy a platform that would end up failing and leaving them with an expensive device that wouldn't have many good games on it. And so despite all of this, the console wasn't a huge success. But think they were getting optimistic, maybe about the American release would be far better. After all, they would have more titles. They were sure to have 8 full titles for the American release. And it wasn't just that that was in the Gizmondo's advantage. It had many things that put it far ahead of the Nintendo DS and the Sony PSP. It had a megapixel camera that they felt that not only could they take photographs with, but could be used in gameplay as people could see a picture of what the camera was looking at it and have it overlaid with game information. A whole exciting field called augmented reality. And they had a GPS device where they could assume that games would involve people physically moving from place to place. It was able to play MP3s so that people could listen to music on the go with it. And it also had a SD card slot so that people could be able to, so people could transfer music or whatever onto the SD or any sort of information and play it on the Gizmondo. These were exciting reasons, surely. These sort of things should put the Gizmondo far, far ahead of what else is out there. Or at least that's what Carl Freer had said to all the investors when he'd been talking to them, and quite neglected to tell all the people who was investing in him, that general gamers just felt that all these devices, while neat, were extremely gimmicky, and at still over 400 euro was slightly too expensive to be worth plunging for. In preparation for the American release, Carl Freer and Stefan Eriksson both went to America. They set themselves up in California and were getting ready to make sure that the launch went well. Of course, it was actually very convenient that they were going to America because there was some external pressure coming to them in the United Kingdom. For instance, Ogilvy was trying to sue them for not paying for their marketing. MTV was trying to sue them because they didn't provide sponsorship for one of the MTV events. And of course, let's not forget the Jordan Grand Prix, who are also trying to sue them at the same time. So perhaps they decided that it was the move to California was probably the best move for all involved at the time. Unfortunately, the United States launch was not successful. And that was, things were bad for a bit. But Michael, back in the UK, kept saying was sure that things would improve. After all, there were plenty more games coming out, some of them which would take advantage of the exciting new Gizmondo features. After all, who couldn't be excited by a great game called Color that involved a lot of gangs running around in a handheld console game that would involve actually moving about and using your GPS? But Michael Carinder was then surprised to suddenly find that both Carl Freer and Stefan Eriksson were resigning. Yes, they resigned, and he was shocked. It turned out that there seemed to be a minor problem back in Sweden with a tabloid newspaper report that seemed to make the connection between Stephen, as he was now, as involved in this gigantic, hugely publicly traded company, and the Stefan that was involved with this Upalasa Mafia group. It was, unfortunately, somewhat in bad reputation for him to be associated, for his criminal past to catch up with him this way. And so Michael find himself at the head of the company without any support in trying to keep things going. So he kept at it. He must keep things going. He must hold things together. And then a month later, the company went bankrupt. Bankrupt with pretty much over $300 million of funds lost in it. And where those funds went is something that even the subsequent investigations couldn't figure out. Meanwhile, back in America, Carl Freer and Stefan Eriksson were trying to just make do. They realized that there were setbacks in life and took a philosophical attitude that sometimes when things don't work out, you just keep at it. It didn't hurt the fact that they both had mansions in California and Carl still had a very nice yacht. And it also didn't help that they were engaged in their next system, this time involving a company called Zero Mobile, which would compete in America's great mobile phone network. And they were even prepared to use a company called Desi TV to once again take it over and gain their shares. But then, something happened. One day, Stefan Eriksson was driving his Ferrari Enzo at high speed down a California highway at 200 miles an hour when tragedy happens. The car, as it spun along, air whipping through over its bonnet in incredible speed, hit a small, almost invisible lip in the road and suddenly went skidding and slamming and drifting right across the place. It spun off the road and slammed sideways into a pole, cutting the car in half. And then suddenly, the car wreckage was streamed across 4 football fields of distance, all across the motorway. And then it stopped. And then Stefan Eriksson got out of the car and dusted himself off. The police were around later to wonder what exactly happened. Obviously, Stefan didn't want to explain that he'd been driving a car at high speed and crashed it, so he said he was just the passenger and that this German guy called Dietrich had been driving the whole time. Of course, Stefan hadn't been driving alone, and indeed, a passenger called Trevor Carney, who is Irish, was also with him in the car. And when Trevor Carney was questioned by the police, he explained that he had actually been driving in a completely different car altogether, and they'd been racing. And when he got out of the car to check on Stefan, the Mercedes that he'd been in just drove off and left him alone. So that's how it worked, but the police were very, very suspicious. The police breathalyzed him, looked at the readings, and found out that he was clearly drunk. To complicate matters, Stefan took out a badge and claimed that he was with an anti-terrorism unit. You see, Stefan had been busy while he was in California. He'd realized that bus companies under California law could have private police forces, and so had formed what was effectively what he claimed to be an anti-terrorist unit, which he used to buy huge amounts of guns without doing background checks. Carl Freer was also involved in this and ended up getting caught a little later while trying to use it to buy a gun without authorization. But for now, Stefan used this advantage and also ended up having an SUV with 2 members from this very security force drive up, tell the police that they were with Homeland Security, and managed to spirit him away. Of course, as things went by, the crash attracted a huge amount of attention, and people were wondering exactly who was this person and what was going on. There was an investigation, and inevitably Stefan realized that people were actually connecting him with all the stuff he'd done in both England and Sweden. To make matters worse, the Ferrari which he crashed wasn't exactly his Ferrari. It was pretty much leased from the Scotland's capital bank owners, who the only reason that they hadn't reported it stolen when the lease payments had stopped was because they believed that the car was still in the UK. However, it wasn't so bad after all. Stefan still had his other Ferrari, a black Ferrari Enzo, rather than a precious red Ferrari Enzo. But unfortunately, that was leased too by a separate bank, Lombards. Fortunately, they also had the Mercedes SLR, which his wife drove. But apparently one day the police stopped her and they ran a background check, found out that it also wasn't owned by them and confiscated the car. Things were getting very, very uncomfortable for Stefan Eriksson. He wasn't sure what to do. He decided that the best thing to do would be to take another trip to another country. But the police found out about this in advance and raided him, arrested him, and charged him with 14 various offences. Through huge amounts of negotiating with the Californian legal system, Stefan ended up spending 3 years in prison before being deported back to Sweden. Meanwhile, Carl Freer continued on. He managed to avoid any serious legal repercussions with being arrested, and then went on to say what he would make to be the next great console, the Gizmondo 2. He would create a new version, it would be hugely successful, things would go brilliantly with it, and it was announced to absolutely not much excitement or even much belief that the project would actually go on ahead as planned. Many people said it was vaporware, that the Gizmondo 2 would never ever be released, and there was no hope for a comeback of this console with people of this kind. And they were right. However, Carl Freer soldiered on, and currently, to this day, remains in California, where he even has a technology blog, which you can read on the online if you want to. As for Stefan Eriksson, well, he went back to Sweden and has since been arrested multiple times for various criminal activities. The end, for now. So, did everybody enjoy BitNote Story Hour? I hope you did, and I hope you had a very nice time hearing about this great big story of epic corporate fraud and criminal charges, Swedish mafia, and so forth. I think that it goes without saying that the Gizmondo isn't highly regarded among most people, among most gamers, really, for a great gaming device. In total, only 14 games were ever released for it. It's one of the consoles that actually has more unannounced or cancelled games for it than games that were actually released. Tragically, it's actually very common for consoles to be launched and then be utterly unsuccessful, or at least very little successful. The classic 3DO of the mid-90s is one great example, and at round about the same time as the Gizmondo, there was also the Nokia N-Gage, which never really took off. But it's just, gamers are kind of used to consoles just not having a good chance. The only way to be sure that a game console is going to be successful is if it had a previous console, because then at least it's got confidence behind it. But even that isn't a good shot, because you never really know where these things are going to go. It's like buying a new console which has just been released is like playing the markets. How successful that decision may turn out to be is more dependent on the future than what you'll immediately get out of it. A lot of people, especially game enthusiasts, buy a console on potential, and so they get pretty damn good at figuring out how much potential a console has. And if you launch a new console, you've got a chicken and egg situation. You need to be able to prove to gamers that there's enough worthy stuff on your console that makes it worth buying. But at the same time, a lot of game studios won't actually develop for your console unless they actually have a decent idea that a lot of people have already bought the console. So, tricky situation. So, having a hugely hyped console turning out to be quite a flop is a bit of a common story in video games. However, having it also involve highly expensive sports cars being utterly bisected and also Swedish mafia and gigantic corporate fraud, slightly different story. Unfortunately, I never really owned a Gizmondo console, so I can't really tell you what the games are actually like. And often, of course, in notes, all people overly focus on the console and don't focus on what the actual games and what they're about. There were actually a lot of games that seemed to have a lot of potential. I mean, I thought Johnny Whatever was an interesting one. That's where you're kind of like this underground, like, rock guy in England, which has been taken over by an Orwellian force that represses culture, and so you have to go around playing the power of rock and riffing out popular tunes like the Star Spangled Banner or that Smoke on the Water thing, I think, and then get people to join your cause and use your powerful guitar to defeat these evil robots that are trying to suppress culture and everything. It actually, I was trying to actually see if I could play some music from that game, but it turned out to be just a licensed Sex Pistols track, i.e. God Save the Queen, so I don't really... So if you're just familiar with that track, that's kind of like the vibe the whole game was going for. So that actually looked like it had potential, but of course it was cancelled. Another console game that looked interesting was Can I Mow the Lawn, Mom?, which is basically about, I think, a kid driving around at a lawnmower. And there was also this other game called Milo and the Rainbow Nasties, which is basically, you know, in a bright, colourful cartoon 3D world, and suddenly a darkness makes everything grayscale and zombies and stuff. And so you're basically Milo, and I think you have to throw paint and colour and return the land to the land it once was. So, you know, there were actually kind of fun game concepts. I don't know how they would have actually played, but, you know, there was some creativity and fun going on in that. And, of course, because of the Gizmondo got cancelled, then none of those games were actually ever completed. Bummer. It also kind of screwed over some of the companies which either supported the platform or actually had actually been bought by Gizmondo themselves. One of these companies was Warthog. Indeed, Warthog seems to have created a lot of their games, actually. Well, they were obviously taken over and renamed Gizmondo. And Gizmondo Manchester, actually, was the one that produced Trailblazer, which I talked about. And it was actually programmed by the guy who made the original Trailblazer for the Commodore 64. It's a frantic speed game where a ball is hurtling forward across the screen. You have to quickly shift it left to right so it bounces off of various platforms and goes onto the right ramp, and whatever it does doesn't fall off the screen. I think some of the recent Sonic games with their quick step movement do something like that. But anyway, I'll just give you a quick sample of the music from that. And that game was developed by Sean Southern as part of Gizmondo Manchester, which of course was originally Warthog for that area. And I believe that game is also available not only for the Classic C64, but a number of platforms, including recently, I believe, the iPhone. I'm not quite sure who composed the music, and I'm actually a little guilty that I actually am playing music from a game I haven't myself played, but like I said, it's just a very expensive console. I'm just not going to go out and buy a game that has like only 14 released games. I mean, there are people like that. I mean, there are people who just really see consoles as sort of like a bit of a huge archive, like to take the museum approach to collecting console games, but me, I just think the most value of the console is in the games, and if there are not enough good games, then it's kind of a little low. Annoying. But interestingly enough, probably what's considered by some people to be the best game on the platform was Myth and Legend, made by Warthog Texas, which was actually, of course, you know, Gizmondo Austin after the renaming. The funny thing was that the game was completely finished, the developers were happy for it, but it was never actually released. To make matters worse, the studio had previously created this well-received Conquest Frontier Wars, which was a strategy game, and were in the process of developing a sequel, which was really like in the bag after another year of work, when they were acquired by Gizmondo. So not only did Gizmondo put them to work for a while creating an entire game that would never actually be released for a platform that was doomed, but Gizmondo actually stopped them from creating the game that they really wanted to create. It can be tragic what happens in the game industry so far, but Myth and Legend, they put a lot of effort into, and they made a fun game. It basically, you run around, it's got a surreal sense of humour, a very thick mix of various mythologies and artists and style to it. So, unfortunately, I've never played it, and like I said, I need a very defunct console to play it. But the least I can do was get my hand in some of the music from that game and play it for your own enjoyment. And if you want to get a style from some of the humor in the game, check out, there's a YouTube video including its intro sequence. This has been David Collins with BitNote. Thank you for listening to the story of Stefan Eriksson and the doomed handheld console.